The Marriott Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Unpost. Paying for a Serviu approved box is easy at the post office. Unpost. Do more. The Marriott Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Unpost. Paying for a Serviu approved box is easy at the post office. Unpost. Do more.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, I have to say that the reaction from our listeners so far to Olive's story is one of tremendous support and admiration for her, for having gone on and on and on. And I presume it will be a matter of some satisfaction to her that it moved forward the treatment centres for cancer generally within the country. She was very nervous doing that, but she wanted to do that interview in order to get her message out. Now, here's a little surprise that might be ahead for An Taoiseach, fresh from, was it Playboy or Time, that we heard about this week and the magazine. But in the Irish Independent today, they're saying that the Taoiseach Enda Kenny is a long shot to collect the Nobel Peace Prize on behalf of the EU. Ireland takes over the presidency, as we all know, in the new year, and the award will be handed over at a ceremony in Oslo. And apparently there's speculation that the prize could be jointly accepted by the current presidency, which is held by Cyprus, and the next presidency, which is Ireland. So that would be another fine day for our Taoiseach, it has to be said. Now, let me just go back to some of the comments that came in about the match. I noticed last night, says this caller, that hardly any of the players even bothered to mouth the words of the national anthem. Maybe their lack of pride in their country contributed to the fiasco. I have to say, in the past, it used to drive me around the bend. Don't know, possibly not for others, when people would chew gum during the anthem. It just annoyed me. Anyway, football. If you think last night's performance in the Aviva was bad, wait till you see the away match. A crowd of overpaid, gutless prima donnas is what we have now, God help us. The Donegal GAA team would have done better than that lot. Well, funnily enough, all the commentators last night were really saying that they were putting the blame at Trapstor because of the way he deals or doesn't deal with the players, and that in some way or another this affects their self-confidence. Anyway, Marion, weren't we playing the second best team in the world? Say no more. Oh, in other words, excuses, excuses. German FA has developed players from its ethnic minorities while we're caught up with Irish grannies. What's wrong with Irish grannies? And poaching players from Northern Ireland, says Ken. Another one says, hi Marion, if Dennis O'Brien wants to do something for the Irish supporters, she should pay off Trapattoni and Delaney and let's build from the ashes again under Mick McCarthy. Mick McCarthy's getting good coverage, it has to be said here. McCarthy would be one, and the CEO should be Owen Hand or Liam Brady, and much more besides, right? But we are going to move on to other people who are having their own little bit of difficulty, it has to be said. And, you know, when something hits the news and you are aware of something happening in someone's life and you imagine yourself in their position and you think, oh, Lord, how awful is that? And then it kind of slips out of your mind again. Well, there was an article in the journal.ie written by one such person, and she started off by saying, friends are marrying, having babies, our family is still in limbo. And they are the words of Alison Doyle, who I do believe is on the line now. Alison, good morning to you.
Hi, good morning, Marion.
Remind us how limbo came about for you.
Limbo came about because this time last year, myself and the other 256 residents of Priory Hall in Donaghmede were evacuated from our homes with 48 hours notice owing to fire safety concerns.
Yeah, I remember.
So a year on, we're still out of our homes with absolutely no resolution in sight and as desperate as we were the day that we left.
Now, your little boy, Sean, he was one at the time.
Yeah, he actually turned two this week, so he's been out of his home as long as he was in it.
And you had a three-bedroom duplex?
We did, yeah.
And just remind us, like, what happened as far as you were concerned?
This week, a year ago, Dublin City Council, as a fire authority, went to the High Court to get an evacuation order owing mainly to the fire issues in Priory Hall, that it wasn't safe for people to live in. So the judge there ordered an evacuation within 48 hours.
And how did the fire safety come to everybody's, or lack of safety, come to everybody's attention?
They had been doing some inspections from, the site was initially inspected before it was even built. Then there was some initial inspections in 2009, but not to the extent of the issues that everybody discovered last year.
And how was it discovered?
Dublin City Council carried out some inspections.
All right.
The builder was given some time to complete some of the fire safety, to remedy the development, but he hadn't completed them by this time last year, and that was why they went to the courts this week.
Now, one of the things that you said was that you don't wish to be defined by Priory Hall, but you say life goes on around you, friends are marrying, having babies, but you're in limbo. But there's an awful lot of to-ing and fro-ing. Where are you living now, by the way?
We're just in Clongriffin, which is not too far from where we were. So most of the residents were all scattered kind of all around the Dublin 13 area in different rented properties.
And are you renting?
Yes.
And what's happening with your mortgage?
Our mortgage is on moratorium at the moment, but our bank has never given more than 3 months at a time. So you know yourself how quickly that time goes around. Every time it's up, we have to apply again. You have to complete a financial statement form. This time it's actually only been given for 2 months. So all the while that we are on moratorium, the capital interest is adding on to it. So our mortgages now are an awful lot higher than when we left Priory Hall.
Dear Lord, let me talk to Graham Usher and Darren Kelly as well. No, stay there, Alison, and chip in if you want to. Graham, how about you? You bought your home off the plans?
I did. I bought my homes off the plan, probably similar to 99% of the people that live there. Myself and my girlfriend at the time moved in 2007. We got married there last year, and then a few months later, obviously, we got the land of our life when we were evacuated from our homes. And I suppose last year it's just been a constant struggle with the banks, with the council and with the government to try and have something done about Priory Hall.
And how's your bank dealing with you?
Similar situation to Alison. I've been given a moratorium. It's 3 months at a time. You need to go back in and you need to request it again, and you just kind of cross your fingers and hope they'll still continue to give us.
And by moratorium, is that interest only or what?
No, basically you don't pay the mortgage, but the mortgage payments and the interest are just added on and added on. And I suppose the problem was, while we only thought we were going to be out of our homes for a few months, it was fine. But if this drags on indefinitely, as Alison said, we fall further and further into debt on the mortgages. And eventually you'll hit a point where, even if the solution was found, the mortgage debt could become so high that families wouldn't be able to pay it.
Darren, what's your situation?
Yes, morning, Marion.
Morning to you.
Yeah, I would be in the same situation as Alison and Graham. We would have a moratorium in place at the moment. And again, it's on a three-month basis, with the interest accruing every month.
And come here to me, where are you living?
I'm in Balmain, which is, it kind of backs onto the Priory Hall complex.
Yeah, it's very nice, isn't it?
Yeah, it's grand. It's okay where we are, but you know, it's a matter of just getting on. It's not.
I know. And who's paying the rent?
Well, the High Court ordered Dublin City Council to accommodate us at the time. That's how we ended up. We were in the Regency Hotel for 3 weeks initially, and then NAMA properties became available. So the properties that we're in are NAMA properties basically, and DCC. Went straight ahead and appealed that accommodation order, and that's still facing us in courts at the moment.
And you say that from when you went in, there were things going wrong.
Yeah, in Priory Hall, luckily enough, I'm kind of handy enough at fixing things around the house, and I kind of noticed different problems. And as we were talking to neighbours, they were saying they were having problems. One girl that lived on the top floor in our block, our floors have flooded three times. We replaced the floors three times in our apartment. And every time the builders came back to fix it, they said it was fixed, and obviously it wasn't. It just kept happening all the time. And time it was a really bad rainfall. She was having trouble.
And what is happening on the site at the moment?
There's absolutely nothing happened. There hasn't been anything happened since Thomas McFeely was ordered off the site last year, back in November of last year. There's been nothing happened at all.
So
this is kind of the incredible thing, Marion, that Dublin City Council actually asked the courts to order Tom McFeely off the site, but they had no backup plan. They ordered him off the site and Priory Hall has just sat empty for the last year.
And I remember the judge, I can't remember which judge it was, but I remember he was pretty adamant about providing protection for you and all of that, and was very angry at the situation you were in. So who decides now who fixes up the houses or the apartments?
Well, that's the situation we find ourselves in. We still don't know the full extent of the problems with Priory Hall. We were initially evacuated over fire safety problems, but a month later, Dublin City Council issued a letter to all the residents. It was a 16-page list of building defects that unrelated to fire safety with the property. So it seems the problems with Priory Hall go far deeper than fire safety.
Yeah, and tell me, could insurance, I presume that everybody had their apartments insured, like just to see it sitting there while you're all in limbo seems...
Well, initially, Marion, when we were told, before we were actually ordered out, just a kind of week prior, the block insurance was pulled on the whole complex, which meant our own personal insurance for our properties was null and void.
Oh, Lord. Well, anyway, you're having your march today. Where is it to from?
We're meeting at Donnymead Shopping Centre at 2 o'clock.
Yeah.
And we're marching to Priory Hall. We'll have some speakers there, and we're looking for as much support as possible, Mary.
Right.
We are expecting a big turnout today.
Okay. Listen, my deepest sympathies to all of you, and thanks for talking to us, and good luck with your march.
1850 715 150.
Now I can concede that a lot of people are exercised by a lot of the material on the programme today, and I'll bring you more of that later. But I want to go quickly, if I may, across the water to Jeff Deehan, who is the creator and producer of The Plane Crash documentary. And what it is a real plane crash. People test crash cars all the time, but no one has ever done this with a full-size jumbo. You're very welcome to the programme, Jeff. How does
Thanks
it work?
For having me.
How do you set up a plane crash?
Well, the first thing you do is you buy a plane. And if you thought it was fun buying a used car, wait until you try to buy a used aeroplane. We could have gone to Kazakhstan and bought one from the Russian mafia, but that didn't seem like a terribly good idea. And eventually we found one lurking in a hangar in the middle of Oklahoma in America. And after the usual things, we went around, kicked the tires, checked the MOT and all that sort of stuff. We were the proud owners of a Boeing 727.
How much?
£300,000 UK.
A snip. I would have thought a snip.
Well, we thought it was a bargain. I mean, a brand new aeroplane that size is millions and millions
of
dollars.
Now, how do you go about getting a pilot to commit to crash a plane?
Well, I was very lucky in that during the course of the research, I came across a bunch of American ex-US Navy pilots whose business was experimental test piloting. And that sounds a little bit like people who strap themselves on the ends of rockets and so on. But it's, in fact, much more complicated than that. These are people who are at the top of the tree in being able to fly jets of various sorts all the way from fighter planes up to big jumbos. And their job is to tell people when things go wrong with aeroplanes and to analyze what the flight patterns are and to advise on how you make them better and make them safer. And they were absolutely right up our street because, of course, that's what we were about. And aircraft safety was the whole raison d'etre of the project.
But, I mean, if you're going to crash a plane, pilots can die too, you know.
Oh, sure. sure. Yeah. Well, in fact, one of the pilots that that eventually flew the plane had been in three previous crashes and survived them all, but he said he wasn't in a hurry to be in one which he didn't survive. So what we did was that, obviously, you can't leave anybody on the plane when it crashes, but it turns out that it's quite difficult to get a plane to take off under remote control. There's all sorts of things that have to be done. The throttles have to be adjusted. The flaps have to be fiddled with and so on. So what we decided to do was that we would have a crew on board who would take the plane off, make sure it got into the air, because also that's to do with safety as well. You take off normally from somewhere quite close to populated areas, and we didn't want the thing falling out of the sky if the remote failed over a city, for instance. So we put three pilots.
I'm very relieved, on board. Yes. Yeah.
We're responsible people. We take health and safety very seriously.
Right.
So we put three flight crew on board the 727, and one of the reasons that we chose the 727 is it has an exit at the very back. So the plan was that they were going to fly the plane until it was close to the crash site. Then they would leave the plane, parachute out of the back, and we would control it in to the crash by a remote control, because unsurprisingly, it turns out to be much easier to crash a plane than it is to get one into the air. So that's what we did.
And, I mean, you set up, they were flying at 140 miles per hour,
yep.
1,000 feet per minute.
Well, the descent speed, the speed at which they were coming down towards the ground was actually, in fact, about 1,500 feet per minute, which is roughly three times faster than you come down if you're in a normal aircraft descent. So we knew it was going to hit pretty hard.
And what an extraordinary project. And I really want to know is what we can all find out from it. But you had the whole thing rigged with cameras and dummies.
Yeah, yes. Cameras, crash test dummies, lots of instrumentation, lots of devices in there that measured how hard the impact was. So, in other words, how many G-forces, you know, the force of gravity, how many times that people would experience in it. And what we found was mostly actually pretty good news.
You just hold that good news for me?
Sure.
Because I have come up to a junction in the programme where we have to, we have the Angelus and then we have a news bulletin and then I'll be back to you.
Right, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much indeed, Michael. Now, we were talking to Jeff Deehan just before the break there about the setup of a plane crash. Jeff, you were about to tell us that the results of this were very good. I mean, most of us would expect, well, first of all, we don't want to be in a plane that crashes, she said, stating the obvious. But you kind of feel that you'd end up going splat and that would be the end of you.
Well, it's very easy to think that, but when I first started looking at this, which is over 4 years ago, one of the first things one of the aviation experts said to me is you have to realize that aeroplanes are very, very strong. And if you saw the aftermath of the crash when the film went out last Thursday, then the front of the plane was quite badly damaged. But from row 7 backwards, it was pretty much intact. And if you were sitting in the front, the first 7 rows, and in the dry language of the scientists, that was probably not a survivable incident. In fact, seat 7A was catapulted 153 meters from the front of the plane. So if you'd been in that one, you weren't going to make it, sadly. But back from there, it's much better news. So rows 8 towards the middle of the plane, then you're getting forces of about 12 times the force of gravity. And that's like being in a very bad car crash. You're going to get injured, you're probably going to break a bone, but you're probably going to be survived. Further back from that, the middle of the plane, the forces peaked at about 6, and that's like being in a medium car crash, so you're going to walk away from that. The very back of the plane, it was only 3, and that's like being in a collision between 2 dodgem cars at a fun fair, so you're going to be pretty good. But the key thing that emerged from this was that all of that advice that everybody who flies on planes ignores about the brace position and everything else is very, very important. So if you think about
it,
you're sitting down. Yeah, absolutely. You think about it. You're sitting down. Your head, it's this great big lump on the end of a big long lever. That's your spine. And if you're traveling forward and you stop suddenly, what's going to happen? Your head's going to carry on going forward. It's going to pivot around your waist on the end of your spine. You're going to go bang into whatever's in front. And that's usually the hard seat back. So if you're not braced, you're going to get your head damaged. If you are braced with your head down on your knees, your head can't go any further, so you're going to be okay. So we saw from the dummies that we had in there, the guy who wasn't braced in one seat was going to have really serious head injuries, probably concussion. He's probably going to be unconscious. The guy in the seat in front of him who was braced, he may suffer something like a twisted ankle or even a broken leg, but he's going to be conscious. And that turns out to be very, very important, because the next thing you've got to do is get ready to get out of that plane quick, because we planned this test so the plane didn't burst into flames. Because if the plane goes up in flames, then that's very, very bad news for anybody left on board, because the toxic fumes that get released are real killers. So if you can keep yourself conscious, able to evacuate the plane quickly, you dramatically improve your chances of making it.
And you know the thing about people sitting at exits and all that and opening the door and getting out, does that work?
Yes. Yes, if you can get a... Well, the toolkit's very simple. Don't have a window seat unless it's by an exit, because you're going to have to get past lots of other people to get out of the plane. So make sure you get an aisle seat. Make sure you're no more than four rows away from an exit in either direction. Count those rows, because if the plane does burst into flames and it's smoky in there, you're not going to be able to see, so you need to be able to count the number of rows you are away from an exit. And get out quick.
Jeff, what in the name of the Lord got you to do this? This is everybody's nightmare. By the way, there's a contradiction in there. You told me a couple of minutes ago the safest place to be is at the back of the plane. If I'm at the back of the plane, how can I be four rows away from an exit? Oh, of course, there's an exit at the back of the plane.
Absolutely, there are, yeah. Yeah, the normal configuration is normally one at the front, one at the back, two over the wings. So you want to be at the back of the plane, but preferably seat yourself within four rows of either of those two exits at the back.
And isn't it very interesting that the really expensive seats are up the front?
Yeah, well, I've heard all the jokes now about how airlines are going to start charging you to sit in the worst seats at the back.
Really? What was the reaction to... By the way, that's still on your player, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
That's
yes,
just for our own audience.
4OD, yes, so people can watch it again. And, well, the reaction was... I mean, you'll know as a broadcaster, one of the things that you hope to do is to make programmes that are good programmes in themselves. So we were hoping to show people something they'd never seen before. But we also wanted to tap into something that we really felt people should know. So, you know, aircraft safety... flying is safe. You know, we shouldn't forget that. It's really very safe indeed. Much safer than getting in a car, for instance. But a lot of people are frightened of it, and I think one of the things that we wanted to do was to give you reassurance that you can survive a plane crash, and to show you the things that you can do to improve your chances of surviving in those circumstances. And we got 3.5 million people on average watched that program on Thursday, with a peak of up to 4 million. So it's clearly something that people are very interested in.
Yeah, very concerned about too. It's the kind of thing you don't want. If just one last thing, seatbelts, were they important?
Yeah. Oh, yes, yeah. Because the other thing that happens is if you don't have your seatbelt on, then what tends to happen is you what's called submarining. I mean, literally, you slide under the seat in front of you. And if you once you're under there, it's very difficult to get out again. You can get stuck. And, you know, as I've said, one of the keys is if the plane doesn't burst into flames, that's probably pretty much okay, because somebody will come and get you out. But the real danger is if you've only got a restricted time, you need to be certain that you can get your seatbelt off, that you can get out of the emergency exits and get yourself away from the plane as fast as possible.
How do you feel about flying now?
I'm a very confident flyer. I mean, I've been doing it for a lot of times, and I've flown on aeroplanes in countries where they don't get maintained properly. And that's my real worry. It's not that there's going to be the one in a million chance of actually being in a crash, which is approximately what it is. It's that somebody forgot to put oil in the engine.
Okay. Where can they see it again?
4OD, Channel 4 on demand.
Channel 4 on demand. Well, listen, thank you very much indeed for talking to us, and I will be very, very careful about seat selection in future.
Without wishing to appear rude, Marion, belt up.
Yeah, okay. Thanks a million. All the best. Bye-bye.
1850 715 150.
Pain. We all know how awful it can make us feel, but did you know that different pain needs different medication? At Doc Morris, we know the best relief for your pain or your child's pain wherever it hurts. And our Doc Morris price promise means you'll always find the best value in over-the-counter medicine, guaranteed. When it comes to pain, speak to your Doc Morris pharmacist first for advice. Doc Morris, your pain experts.
Where would you go to buy a fresh new sofa? Somewhere with a large range, great value for money, and friendly, knowledgeable staff. A store that will stand by the structure of their sofas for 10 years. If these things are important to you, there's only one place to buy a new sofa. Harvey Norman, your sofa superstore.
My trainer says I'm a few seconds slower than I used to be. My wife says my grey hairs look rather distinguished. My brother says we should be looking forward, not back. My broker says I should be looking at Zurich.
If you want pension performance, you should like what they say about Zurich, because Zurich has the best pension returns in Ireland over the last 20 years. And we deliver the peace of mind that comes with internationally recognised financial strength.
That's it. I'm moving to Zurich.
Talk to your broker today or call Zurich on 1850 202 102.
Zurich Life Assurance PLC is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Returns based on Rubicon Investment Consulting Survey, September 2012. Strength relates to Zurich Insurance Group.
Who do you talk to about your financial matters? How about your local financial broker, who's qualified, regulated, and will offer impartial and professional advice, plus a choice of companies? For expert guidance on life insurance, pensions, investments, or mortgages, visit financialbroker.ie. You'll find useful information and a register of financial brokers in your area. It's your money, your future, and your financial broker will guide you in making the most of it.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Unpost. With mybills.ie, you can pay bills online for free. Unpost. Do more.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, a number of callers were on. One, Loretta says, Marion, I'd like to say thank you to Olive for the correction of the entire system in relation to breast cancer. May she have a long and happy life from here on in, and so say all of us. It's not scary, Marion. It's downright disgrace in this day and age. That poor woman, God bless her resolve. Another one, Marion, I salute this brave woman and ask, where did the fault lie? Human error by tree or equipment failure? Well, it was alleged anyway that it was human failure with one person anyway, who was a locum, that he had a particular rate of error. Now back to Des Trapp, and this one comes from Des, and it's about Trapp and the recession. And he says, like so many Irish soccer fans, I have watched the team collapse over recent months. There was a certain inevitability to last night's drubbing. It was coming. We all knew it. If we can't afford to, quote, sell Trapp, unquote, by breaking his contract, why not put him into the NAMA process? He fits the criteria. Overpriced asset of limited, if any, value, purchased during the boom, costing a fortune to maintain, returning nothing on the investment. He could be bought in at a heavily discounted rate to join the other overpriced Celtic Tiger monuments, for which thank you very much, Des. Marion, I'm a lawyer, and I can tell you that, this is a very interesting one. I was going to read out another story to you this morning. This comes from a lawyer. I can tell you that most lawyers agree that the legal system we have for determining medical negligence is a racket. The focus is not on delivering a service to the public. Instead, it's about shifting blame and stonewalling and protecting slovenly practices. There's absolutely nothing in the Minister of Justice's new legal services bill to address any of this, and absolutely nothing in the Minister's bill to reduce costs. Because a number of papers this morning were covering that case taken by the Duffy family, which they lost, and terribly worryingly, but I mean, that's the risk if you're going to go for something like that. But they have to pay half the costs. And the half the costs are $500,000. It just strikes me, how can all the costs come to $1 million? It's just such a staggering amount of money. And with that, I see that some of her own people are the family's people, are legal people, are not going to charge for their own fees. But if it takes you $1 million, if it costs $1 million to take a case like that, it fairly takes it out of the reach of most citizens of the state. You would think, anyway, they're worried, sick, they're afraid they're going to lose their home, and I suppose that's the terror for everybody going to court, because there you go, it is a risky business. Now, we're always talking, well, we're sometimes talking about self-improvement and improving your health and improving your life and all that kind of thing. And a number of people have been doing research on the benefits of fasting. Now, the Catholic Church always had Lent, and the Muslims have Ramadan. And Dr. Michael Mosley, who is a BBC reporter and presenter and a medical doc, you were setting yourself a goal and you were looking at new research about fasting.
That's absolutely right. Hi, good morning there.
Good morning to you. Talk me through the research that you did. You wanted to find a way to live longer, stay younger and lose weight. Hallelujah, that's what everyone wants.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's not an ambitious goal, is it?
No, not really.
Not really, yeah. So I was just curious. I mean, I've been making science programmes now for about 20 years for the BBC, along with sort of doing medicine. And I've looked at a lot of diets down the years, and I've always regarded them as a bit nonsense.
Yeah.
And so, but I had a, I discovered I'm what's called a toffee, which means I'm thin on the outside but fat inside.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a bunch of medical tests and discovered that I was kind of moving towards being diabetic and I had very high cholesterol. And so I thought I'd better do something about it. And then I decided it'd be interesting to kind of do it as part of a science program, really look at the science of it and investigate. And one of the people I started talking to was about fasting. And I've always regarded fasting as essentially a sort of spiritual activity.
Yes.
So I was surprised that recently there's been a really big amount of research that went into it. So I started to get interested and I went off and I talked to a lot of researchers and I started fasting myself.
And when you say fasting, when you started, is this nothing except water?
Right. There are lots of different forms of fasting, and that's kind of what the film was about, I suppose. But the first thing I decided to have a go at was a three-day fast. And you can either do the kind of German model or the Russian model. The Russian one basically is you nothing but water and cold showers and running around in the woods. The German one is a bit more generous.
Yeah.
You're allowed like 100 calories a day. And you do fast for maybe 3 or 4 days or something like that. So that's kind of what I went for. I actually went for a 4-day fast, eating 50 calories a day, which is basically, it was a sort of a soup. And I also had as much coffee, tea, water, liquids as I wanted, as long as I had no calories in them. And that's what I did for 4 days, and they measured me beforehand and afterwards.
And?
What I discovered is the thing we were really interested in was a thing called IGF, which is insulin-like growth factor. It's kind of a hormone, and what it does is it drives your cells, and it's kind of a measure of the rate at which you are aging, because when it's high, it accelerates things like cancer. You were talking about breast cancer earlier.
Yes.
All those things, because your body is, you know, we're descended from sort of Stone Age creatures, and in the wild, basically, your body's constantly on the go. And the question is, how can you kind of slow things down to allow a bit of repair to go on? And it turns out fasting enables you to do that. So what we were looking at was, could I reduce my IGF levels? And that's one of the things we measured before. And in fact, after 4 days of fasting, they had halved. I also lost about sort of 3 or 4 pounds weight, and my blood glucose levels went down from borderline diabetic to pretty well normal. So
and
that was all good stuff.
Did the weight stay off?
Well, what happened then is I decided, look, I'm not going to be doing that on a very regular basis because it was quite tough. So I wanted to see whether there were kind of milder forms of fasting. And what I discovered is another thing the scientists are researching, which is called 5-2. And there, basically, what you do is you kind of fast 2 days a week. The Muslims always advocated, Muhammad apparently said, Mondays and Thursdays you should sort of reduce your intake. So I thought I might as well do that. And what you do then is you eat 600 calories on those days. So it's not an absolute fast, it's just quite a severe calorie restriction on 2 days a week. And I did that for about 6 weeks. And after that, what happened is I'd lost about a stone.
And you ate perfectly normally?
Yes.
For the other 5 days?
Absolutely.
A week.
In fact, I probably ate. I allowed myself sort of biscuits and all the normal vices. And on the 2 days, I basically just I ate 600 calories, which is mainly by eating a load of vegetables and things like that. I mean, you can eat reasonably well on 600 calories. You're just not going to be eating pork pies. But
indeed.
On the other 5 days, I kind of ate normally.
This person, Dr. Krista Varady,
yes,
in Illinois, she did a double test, one with people who were allowed to eat kind of horrible, bad for your food,
yes,
and others who had to eat healthy food. Tell me about how that went.
Yes, okay. But she was investigating something called the alternate day fast, which is a slightly more extreme version of the 5-day. And what you do there is one day you eat whatever you fancy, and then the next day you eat 600 calories. And she took her group and she divided them in two, as you suggest. And one lot were allowed on their, you know, eating days, their feeding days. They were allowed to eat, you know, a normal high-fat American diet where you're eating pizzas and things like that. And the other group were put on a low-calorie diet. And she followed them for a period, I think it was 3 months. And what she discovered is the group who were on the junk food diet actually did better. They lost more weight. And they did just as well in terms of the improvements in their cholesterol and their blood glucose, which she and they were not expecting.
Quite extraordinary. It's quite extraordinary because, I mean, at times with fasting for Lent, I mean, there'd be arguments in houses about what was a collation and what was a meal and what wasn't. But obviously there were health attachments to it as well.
Yes, I think that's what you discover really is the great religions have always sort of appreciated these things. It's things like, you know, meditation, which is now being intensively studied by scientists as well, and they discovered the huge health benefits from meditation and from what they now call mindfulness.
Right.
So it turns out the great religions,
they got a thing or two right.
Have understood these things.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, thank you very, very much indeed. That was Dr. Michael Mosley. Different approach and not extreme, which is rather good. Anyway, we'll take a break now. And you're welcome back to the programme now. Another caller was on about Mick McCarthy and the match last night. Mick McCarthy made only one big mistake. He should have told Irish people and Mr. Dunphy to stick the manager's job after the World Cup homecoming 04. You're too good for us, Mick. Don't come back, says Anonymous. Well, anyway, we'll have the same bald Mr. Dunphy on the panel tomorrow on the programme. Listen, I'm just going to read you one of these now and move on. But it's kind of quite bothering the amount of misdiagnosis stories that are coming in. This one, I won't give the name. My sister, single parent with a six-year-old son, breast cancer, not picked up by GP in January. No referral to breast clinic, despite there being a lump and extensive family history of breast cancer. She's just had a mastectomy, now undergoing chemo, to be followed by radiotherapy. All could have been avoided if she'd had a timely referral. Please, GPs, any lump or bump in or near the breast must be referred. You're putting families and children's parents and guardians at risk when you delay. This came from a concerned sister and aunt. But it's just surprising that we've just got quite a few people ringing in about misdiagnosis. So these kind of things, and I actually happen to know of another appalling one where somebody was more or less given a death sentence and there was nothing wrong at all. So anyway, things can go one way or the other. Now, I've been joined in studio by Joe O'Shea, our own Joe O'Shea, who usually we're talking to about television programmes and so on and so forth. But you're going to talk to us about a very unusual kind of social events that people might be interested in. So you're very welcome to studio. But having welcomed you into studio, I'm rudely going to go to somebody else and I'll come back to you then. And who I am going to go to is the queen of keeping your house clean, and she's called Aggie McKenzie, and she's involved in, she's a dirt detective. We did household tips a little while ago. People were very interested in them. Aggie, good morning or good afternoon to you, and you're welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon to you, Marion. Hello, how are you?
I'm good, and thanks for talking to us. Now, some of your own favourite ones, I'm just going through them. Inside of a microwave.
Yes, we've all had that curry explosion inside the microwave, haven't we? We're reheating it. And unless you wipe it up straight away, then what happens is everything goes a bit hard on the sides and the roof, and then it's really hard to get off. But an easy way to work around this is to get a plastic bowl or a glass bowl of very hot water, put a few slices of lemon in, stick that in the microwave, turn it on for a few minutes on high. And what happens then is the steam from the hot water circulating around the microwave, it just loosens all the particles and makes it really easy to mop up. And also the lemon slices give it all a nice smell.
Very nice smell, I would have thought. Smelly washing machine. How do you get a smelly washing machine?
Well, a lot of people find that they, you know, when they open the door, there's a sort of fusty smell inside. You know that word, don't you? And it's because a lot of people are washing nowadays on 15 and 30 degree washers, which is great for the environment, but it's not so great for the inside of your washing machine, because if you are washing, say, sheets and towels and underwear that have got a heavy load of bacteria, they aren't being killed off at those low temperatures. So it's the gases from the bacteria that are making the bad smell. And the only way to get, well, the best way to get rid of that is to run your washing machine on the hottest possible cycle with a cup of clear vinegar in the empty drum. Just run the cycle at the hottest wash, and you'll find that that will get rid of the smell entirely. And then after that, if you do a sort of 60 degree wash, I'd say about once a week, that'll keep all the bad smells away.
And how do you get rid of the smell of the vinegar?
It doesn't stay. It just doesn't stay.
Right.
It goes in the rinsing of the cycle.
Right. Now, limescale. Limescale can be in all sorts of places if you...
Yeah,
if,
do you have a lot of hard water where you are?
Very much so.
Well, there's a lot of limescale destroying products on the market, and they're not good for the environment, and they're expensive. Again, good old vinegar. So if you've got sort of limescale around your taps, for instance, and I'm talking about plain chrome taps, if you've got fancy finishes on your taps, don't do this because the vinegar will wreck them. But if it's ordinary chrome, it won't. So what you do is just douse a few sheets of either cotton... paper towel, a kitchen roll, or a wad of cotton wool, douse it in vinegar, wrap it round your taps, leave it overnight, and you'll find that in the morning the limescale will just flake away.
Same in the loo?
The loo, yes, you could do it in the loo, or I'll tell you what else is good for lavatory bowls and baths, porcelain baths, is to... get some pumice stone, you know, the stuff that you use for skin on your feet.
Yeah.
If you just rub, just dampen it and rub the inside of the bowl with the, wearing rubber gloves, of course, with the pumice stone, it's hard enough to deal with limescale, but it's soft enough not to damage the inside of your bowl.
Not exactly the most enjoyable of tasks, I would have thought.
No, but limescale's not very nice to look at either. Oh, you know, it's a very satisfying job, actually. It's very satisfying. It's a thing to do to get...
do you find that satisfying, Joe?
I could think of other things I could do that would be a bit more satisfying than that.
Anyway, you reckon it is. But the other thing that you wanted to talk about was... they were still in the bathroom, obviously mouldy, or sometimes pronounced here mouldy, shower curtains.
Oh, you say mouldy.
Sometimes.
Sometimes. Some people say it sometimes. Yes, I mean, the reason that for mould in bathrooms is because the room's not ventilated well enough. So, really, you need to be opening your windows at least once a day and letting all the steam out, because if it's enclosed in there, then it just... it makes the place mouldy. But if you have ended up with mould, then all you need to do is get a bit of bleach and dilute it with 50-50 bleach warm water, and using an old toothbrush, just rub along the area that's affected, and that will get rid of the mould spores and hopefully the discolouring. But if it doesn't, it means it's got underneath the sealant or the grouting. You need to replace it then.
You enjoy this stuff, Aggie, don't you?
Well, I've just kind of been doing it for years, and I just know. I'm always amazed at how... See, I think I don't really know anything, and then I'm always amazed at how people don't really know this stuff.
Well, I think that's enough work for people for the weekend. Your next series, which is called Storage Hoarders, that's starting fairly soon.
Yeah, it's starting, I think, the middle of December at some point. Just
right.
Filming at the moment. And it's absolutely fascinating. It's about people who put stuff in storage. And it's always, supposedly for a short time, until they get things sorted out. But a lot of stuff ends up being left for years and years.
Without a doubt.
Costing thousands and thousands of pounds in storage fees.
Okay.
And it's a kind of a... head in the sand thing. And then, people realise actually the stuff in there often isn't worth anything like the money they spent on the storage. It's a little bit mad. And so we help them, you know, get the stuff
get
out.
Get their act together.
Sell it and deal with
okay.
it.
Okay. Yeah. Listen, thank you very, very much indeed, Aggie, for that. By the way, just with reference back to the plane crash, Mary in Cork said, thanks, Marion. I'm just about to embark on a long-haul flight. Listen, you got very good advice there on where to sit in the plane, not up front, way down the back. All very good tips. Another caller from Tipperary, Liam, says, Marion, I'm terrified of flying. And after watching that plane crash programme, I'm even more terrified. Never again. Well, you shouldn't be more terrified, Liam, because he said it's very reassuring. And there's all those guides that we get about, you know, brace yourself, that it actually works and it's the safest way to travel. So there you go. Anyway, I don't think I'll be looking it up myself. Be a bit squeamish. Now, as I said, Joe Shea is with me. We were talking to you about your book, Murder, Mutiny and Mayhem, but we're now going more gently about life. And you were looking up unusual activities, many of them free, that come up through websites, really. Well, not all of them.
Not all of them.
Yeah.
But, you know, the winter nights are drawing in. People might be wanting to look to shake up their social or cultural lives. And there's actually a lot out there. And a lot of it is free as well and very easy to access. And a good place to start is meetup.com, which is a fantastic website that's nationwide. And basically, you think of it as...
It's not a dating agency.
No, it's not a dating agency. Although there are elements in there of meeting new friends, but it's not your classic dating agency. What it is imagine a joint virtual community notice board that contacts you. So you go on to meetup.com, you register with your email address and a password, and you sign up for various different groups. Now, there are groups on here of like-minded people who, let's say, are into hiking, into Thai food, into learning a language, cinema, knitting, tennis, you name it. And what you do is you sign up to these groups and you give them your email address, and every couple of days or couple of weeks, they'll send you a notice saying, we're having a meeting here, or we're doing this activity, or we're going to go for a walk along this beach. And it's absolutely fantastic because literally no matter what you're into, there's something on there for everybody.
And who organises it?
The meetup is a sort of a facilitator. There are organisers who sign up to organise these groups.
Right, yeah.
But I mean, the great thing is as well, you can cross kind of reference things. So let's say you live in Cork, you're into hill walking, art galleries and Thai food,
right?
You can sign up for all three groups and you will get a regular updates on all those groups, and maybe, who knows, you might go hill walking with Thai food. It's entirely possible.
Yeah.
But it's a
It sounds very sociable in a non-pressured way.
Exactly. You know the way people say it's hard to get friends to organise things or to meet new people or to do activities? And one of the things I really like about it is there are lots of groups that are for non-drinkers. And non-drinkers tend to get left out in the cold a lot in Ireland. You know, if people organise things, and it will revolve around a restaurant or a couple of glasses of wine or the pub or whatever.
Yeah.
There's a group called A Sober Slice of Dublin, who sound like good crack altogether, because they go out and they do things, lots of good activities, but it doesn't involve drinking. So you don't feel that pressure of go on.
Yes, you will.
I also like the Dublin Randomness Group, who have 2,000 members. This is a good example of the kind of thing that's on there. The Dublin Randomness Group, 2,000 members, and they just do random fun things. They're going to see Oliver in the Grand Canal Theatre, not all 2,000 at the same time, but a group of them. So you can take part or you can't take, you RSVP or you don't.
Right.
There's no pressure.
Sounds like a really good one. Now, the Wild Strawberries.
Yeah, in the Irish Film Institute in Temple Bar, which is a great facility, and they screen great movies. This is a film club for the over 55s, and they do twice monthly on Wednesdays or Thursday mornings. They put on a special screening of a classic movie or a new movie. They're normally good choices. They don't go for the obvious. I mean, recent ones, they did the Brazilian classic, a new cinema classic, Central Station. And they also did the Woody Allen movie, Whatever Works, recently, which is a kind of an overlooked one, which is a very good Larry David's in it. And it costs you $3.90 is about the average price. So you get a concession on the ticket. You also get a free cup of tea or coffee after, so you can sit down.
Bit of sociability.
What did you think of the movie? Did you enjoy it? Didn't you enjoy it? And you're encouraged to kind of discuss it and make it a bit more social. Like, some people like going to the cinema by themselves. I do. I find it a real treat.
Yeah.
Other people like to sit around later and have a chat about it, and the Wild Strawberries do that. You can go on to the Irish Film Institute website and they give you all the details there.
Right. Okay. Now, well, of course, this is wherever. That's the National Gallery.
Yeah, the National Gallery, Merrion Square West, every people will know the National Gallery. On their website, they have a What's On section, and it is very recommended you go on and have a look because they do a lot of activities around the National Gallery. A lot of them are free as well. For instance, and I didn't know this but when I was doing the research for you guys, today at 2 p.m, every Saturday, they have a free gallery guided tour. So you can just, and there's no booking, you just turn up and you walk around a big group of people and, they, you know, you get an expert who tells you about the significance of this. And I think that's a lovely way to spend the afternoon. One thing about the National Gallery is, it's, I don't know if you've gone in there recently, but it's in, obviously, in the centre of Dublin. It's a real oasis. It's a beautiful building and it's very calm. And it's a great to while away a couple of hours if you've got a couple of hours spare. But definitely have a look at their website and have a look at their What's On section because they have a wide range of activities, lots of them free.
One last one you wanted to talk was people, Francophiles.
Yes, the French Club in Odessa in Dame Court in Dublin. Odessa is a club and a restaurant, and it's a very nice space. It's been there for years, and I go there quite a bit myself. But the French Club is offering beginners French language classes with a native French speaker and an accredited tutor, and also French classic French cooking. So you sign up. Now, this costs $22.50 a night, and it started last Wednesday, but it goes on every Wednesday for the next 6 Wednesdays.
Right.
So you basically go along, and you have your meal, and you also learn French. And they concentrate on how to order in French, how to order food, how to order wine, and conversational French, but also with a slant on, you know, getting by in French restaurants.
Right.
A lot of us love France and go to France on a regular basis. So it sounds, again, so sociable, fun, and the food sounds great because it's all classic French, almost farmhouse cooking. So it sounds really a really pleasant evening and not that expensive when you think about it.
Right. Well, actually, I saw something in the paper today about Nigella Lawson.
Oh, yes. I saw
French
that. What did she say? France is a...
bread and butter.
Yeah, and she said France is a silly little place that you have to get through to get to Italy, which is not going to endear her to the great nation of France.
I wouldn't have thought so. Now, we are going to move on to films and telly. And we've been joined by Mark. But before I go to you, I just want to read just a couple more calls because people are very exercised now about both the football and indeed that woman. Marion, it's absolute drivel blaming the manager. This is back to the football. The present team is useless, can't even pass a ball. Well, I think part of the problem is that they're kind of nearly instructed not to. Anyway, Germany put 20 passes together without an Irish player even able to dispossess them. You can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. Then don't forget, Marion, Mick McCarthy. Oh, here we go again. Don't forget, Marion, Mick McCarthy would have won the World Cup for us if Roy Keane hadn't thrown his toys out of the brand.
it'll never be forgotten, will it? No.
Did you see the match last night?
I did, yes. And it was fairly depressing, really.
Yeah.
And actually, talking about Roy Keane, a friend of mine was on to me and saying, I suppose you say Roy should be the next guy in the job. And I think it would be, if you're looking for, you know, if nothing else, it would certainly liven the place up anyway if Roy was in charge of the national team.
Can't see things getting boring under those circumstances. How about you, Mark? Did you see it?
I watched the highlights later on, but I mean, I think the alarm bells were going off from the Euros about that team. You know, it looks like a team in decline.
Listen, you're terrible knowledgeable, the pair of you. James got on to say, when the elephants dance, the grass gets trampled. When the elephant fight, the grass gets trampled. What's he saying to me?
I have no idea, to tell you the truth.
Right, okay. We'll ponder these things now. Where are we going from here? I gather you're in Anglo the Musical.
Yeah, we're about to start rehearsals on Monday. It's a really, really interesting project, I think.
It's a puppet show, is it?
It's partly puppet, partly... I mean, it's very much like, if people know the Avenue Q style, it's like actors working with puppets, but it's got a really good script by Paul Howard. And he's, you know, there's some killer one-liners on it. There's some great songs in it. Put a zero on the end. He's a friend.
Was he involved with Roy Keane the musical as well?
No, he wasn't. But he was involved in all the Ross O'Kyle Kelly stage shows. Right. But this is really it's really exciting. Opening in the Grand Canal on the 14th of November.
Grand job. Now, moving swiftly on.
On the Road, Jack Kerouac's On the Road is still considered, for many people, a defining novel on the post-war beat generation. Yep. And as a teenager, if you were on a personal quest to find belief and the meaning of life, and Marion, who wasn't, this certainly was the book for you. Kerouac himself wanted Marlon Brando directed in the 50s, but the material at the time seemed a bit risque. Francis Ford Coppola has had the rights since 1978. It's passed through lots and numerous directors and screenwriters since then, and it eventually landed on the lap of Walter Salles, a very, very talented Brazilian film director who had a big hit a couple of years ago with The Motorcycle Diaries. Jose Rivera, he's written the screenplay, and he takes both the 1957 published version and the 1951 scroll version, and he's come up with a fairly faithful adaptation of the Road Journey with a few small detail changes. The English actor Sam Riley plays Sal Paradis, who was Kerouac himself. He's a Kerouac surrogate, I suppose you could call him.
Yeah.
An aspiring writer living in Queens, New York, in 1947, and not long after the funeral of his father, for people who know the book, this wonderful, wonderful sequence. He meets this character, charismatic character called Dean Moriarty, who was based on a notorious guy at that time called Neil Cassady. He was a sort of a pot-smoking, car-stealing womanizer. Moriarty's life is a kind of an endless party that Sal is naturally drawn towards. He goes to visit him in Denver. He discovers that Moriarty is now in his second relationship and he's about to become a father. So basically, they just all go on the road and they're joined by people like Carlo Marx, who was based on Allen Ginsberg, the beat poet. They go down, there's a lovely sequence in this film where they go down to New Orleans to meet Old Bull Lee, a.k.a. William Burroughs, played here by Viggo Mortensen. Many people said that this book is unfilmable, and maybe that is the case, but, you know, there are certain qualities within
the book.
Did
you read the book, Joe?
I did, yes. Yeah, I was 19, I think, something.
Yeah, it's a terrific book, but, Joe, you know, there's so much quality in the book that you just simply can't, you know, get it on the screen. Yeah. Everything looks authentic, from the cars to the costumes, but I think that, you know, we'll still be talking about the book in 20 years' time when the film is long forgotten. It's a kind of real case of this one is a kind of close but no cigar.
Right. Okie doke. And the next one we're doing is a fantasy romance.
Yeah, and Marianne, you know, I've been here so many times saying, you know, that we're inundated week after week with kind of forgettable romantic comedies, most of them boringly predictable and usually starring people like Jennifer Aniston and Matthew McConaughey. So it's good to report that this movie, Ruby Sparks, although a rom-com, is prepared to go places that others wouldn't dream of going. It also stars two very unlikely leads in Paul Dano, who people might remember as the crazed preacher from There Will Be Blood. Do you remember he was kind of very, very, he hung around with Daniel Day-Lewis's character. Really strange individual. So as I say, he's a very unlikely lead here, but he's very, very good. And he's also joined by Zoe Kazan, daughter of Ilya Kazan. I suppose for many people, Hollywood royalty, and she's written the screenplay as well. Dano plays Calvin. He's a 20-something writer who hasn't had a hit for 10 years. He had a huge bestseller when he was 19. He's been suffering from writer's block. He starts dreaming about this ideal woman who he calls Ruby Sparks, and his psychiatrist, very funny here, Elliot Gould, urges him to write about her. He does, and guess what? She turns up in his life. At the beginning, he thinks he's hallucinating until other people see her too, and he's kind of, you know, he realizes that, you know, he can change her mood and her behavior by simply sitting down at a typewriter and changing and writing a sentence. It's very much a kind of a play on the Pygmalion myth.
All right.
You know, the sculptor who falls in love with his statue, with a little bit of Dr. Frankenstein thrown in. I mean, the main thrust of the film is really having matching this beautiful woman up. What precisely is he going to do with her? At one stage, he says she's fluent in French, and next thing you see, she's talking with subtitles.
She could join up now with Joe down in the Odessa.
Exactly. I'll bring Ruby along next week.
But inevitably, he starts to revert to his boorish ways. She develops an independent streak, and he has to, you know, go to the typewriter to manipulate her to stay. There are further personality shifts that he has to change throughout the movie, most of them very funny. Now, interestingly, it's directed by Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris, who are a husband and wife team, who made a huge splash in 2006 with, I thought, one of the best movies of 2006, Little Miss Sunshine,
which was a
small indie
that.
Hit, another kind of a road movie, but it was very, very funny. There's some brilliant support here from Annette Bening and Antonio Banderas and Steve Coogan. Look, it's quirky, it's offbeat. I thought it was really a whip-smart script, and it's well worth a look.
You didn't see it?
I didn't see it, but it sounds like a great movie.
It does, yeah. Okie doke. Did you see, by the way, the plane crash?
I did, yes. And the one crumb
what
of,
did you think?
The one crumb of comfort I got from it was that all the people, the smug guys in first class, they'll be the ones that go when the plane goes down. So the next time I'm walking past all those guys sitting down with their champagne, I'll be thinking of that.
Absolutely. You didn't see it, Marty?
No, absolutely. No.
A lot of people are kind of getting in and saying, don't be talking to me on a plane today. Would it put you off getting on a plane?
I flew across the Sahara once. And they were showing us how to use our life jackets, and I was thinking we're flying across the Sahara, so no, it wouldn't put me off using a plane at all.
Right. Okay, yeah. Well, now I know four rows from the entrance, aisle seat down the back. Where are we going to start? Oh, this isn't the most cheery of things we're starting with. No.
But it is an important, I think, documentary, and I think a lot of people are going to be watching it. It's A Time to Die on RT1, 9:35 on Monday, and it's an hour-long documentary telling the story of people who wish to end their lives by euthanasia. Very much in the news at the moment, there's a bill in the UK that looks like it could actually go through. They've tried a few times before. And basically we follow the subjects over a space of 2 years, looking at the moral, ethical and legal issues they face, but also the human issues. We meet Tom Curran, whose partner, Marie Fleming, a lady called Marie Fleming, suffers from MS, and she wants him to help her to die. And there's also a Catholic philosopher, Jean Vernier, who's actually very opposed to this, takes the Catholic view, the Church's view. And I think it's going to throw up a lot of food for thought. It's a difficult subject, but hopefully it's handled well. And, I think people are going to find it very interesting.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, it's not even confined to which religious denomination. It's just a moral human dilemma. Anyway, Kill at Will.
Yeah, people might be familiar with the Trayvon Martin case in Florida in February this year. A 17-year-old black kid was shot dead by a neighbourhood watch guy called
George Zimmerman,
which became a huge, huge story in the States involving gun law, race relations, the whole lot. And this is Panorama, BBC One, Monday at 8:30 p.m. They're basically looking at how the gun lobby groups have basically written the law in the US.
They have amazing power.
Incredible. The NRA are just such a powerful group, and even like the Democrats don't touch these guys. Yeah. Nobody touches these guys. Yeah. Even after the terrible shootings we've seen in the States, the NRA, the gun laws are virtually untouchable, and this Panorama doc looks at that through the lens of these the Trayvon Martin case.
Yeah, no, I remember it well. I mean, people were absolutely shocked. And I gather that Obama's afraid to open his beak against the NRA as well.
It's political suicide, as seen as in the States.
It's extraordinary how one sweep of water called the Atlantic can produce such completely opposing views. I mean, Europeans, broadly speaking, think they're crazy. But anyway, there you go. We move now on to glitz and glamour, is it?
Yeah, a bit of a change-up, a bit of fluff maybe. The Ireland's ultimate debutante on TV3 on Wednesday at 8 p.m. It's teenagers competing to be crowned the ultimate debutante, and I didn't know we still had debutantes in this country, but by model Roz Purcell, a stylist and an etiquette expert called Noel Cunningham. And the first three hopefuls are girls, a girl from Tipperary, a girl from Westmeath and a girl from Dublin, who are sort of into the look side of things.
Yeah.
The debutant. I think it could be fun. Listen, it could be fun. And it's worth checking out anyway and giving it a go. But I did want to mention, if possible, The West's Awake. Now, I normally wouldn't mention a repeat, but I watched this the other night in TG Carr, and I would urge people, if you haven't seen it, please see this tonight. It's on TG Carr tonight at 11:35, even if you're not into sport. Basically, they follow the Connacht rugby team for a year to their first qualification in the Heineken Cup.
Oh, yeah, great.
And this is a really, really great show. And I said, even if you're not into rugby, because they talk to the fans, and Connacht rugby is a sort of an endangered species and has been for a long time.
Yeah.
Very passionate fans, but they've been kind of on the edge, you know. They don't have the glamour and the money of the guys in Leinster, or maybe the profile of the guys in Munster. And I think this just is a great little doc that really tells a great story. But
I see you nodding your head too.
Well, I'm really looking forward to it, Joe. Yeah. I mean, I saw it on the listing earlier, and I looked at the 6-minute promo.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's only 9 years ago since Connacht, you know, since the IRFU were going to disband Connacht
Rugby.
That's
right. Yes.
So
yeah.
I mean, you know, I love sports documentaries, and I believe it contains a lot of strong language.
One word of warning: that this is a rugby dressing room at halftime in a crucial game. So, you know, if you're easily offended, have your finger over the mute button, because Eric Elwood cuts loose, and you need that mute button if you don't like swearing. Because believe me, it's hard going.
Okay, well, I will remember that, and of course, it's appropriate, I suppose, because It's all starting up again, isn't Dining Book Up today?
Getting into the season again.
Okay, well, listen, thank you very much indeed. A lot of texts on apparently asking about the Meetup website. So can you mention it again? And we will put it on ours as well. It's just meetup.com.
And I'm sure that the brief that I did for you guys, you can put on your website.
Great
all
stuff.
The details are there.
Okay, thank you very, very much indeed. We've huge reaction from our listeners today. Somebody explaining the elephants thing to me, but I'd have to read it twice to figure out what it's saying. But that's all we've time for today. The programme today was produced by the series producer Anne Farrell, research Elizabeth O'Neill and Elaine Carraher, broadcasting coordinator Louise Fox, on sound Barry Cavan. Back to you tomorrow at 11 to 1. Until then, a very good day to you.
The Marion Finucan Show on RTE Radio 1 with Unpost. Our tax-efficient one-for-all gift cards can make